Okay, tonight I want to tell you something about the beginnings of the Reformation in Italy, about the beginnings of the move of God in that land. Its commencement there was not unlike its commencement in other European countries. As with them all, we have to go to Wittenberg, and we begin in 1517. Historians have focused, whenever they deal with the Reformation in any country, historians always generally focus on the nailing of the 95 Theses as the real beginning of the Reformation. And to do that for any European country, they go back to Germany and to Wittenberg in 1517. And here we have a photo, artist's impression of Luther nailing the 95 Theses to the door at the Castle Church in Wittenberg. So we could say that that broke the ice. If we look upon Europe as covered with the ice of the cold ice of the papacy and Romanism, we could say that the hammer that cracked the ice happened in Wittenberg in 1517. And the cracks in the ice were soon spreading very rapidly, north, south, east and west. And the ice began to crack even on the other side of the Alps in the land of Italy itself. And it wasn't long before the Pope himself was looking down at some of those cracks. So Luther first broke the ice, and the after effects of it travelled far and wide, as we know. And it was the same in Italy. Now, it took a few years for the Pope to get too worried about it before he really realised the cracks are bad and there's water beginning to appear and the whole thing is in danger of falling apart, the whole papal system. So he wasn't too worried at the start, but then he began to get severe headaches and intense worries about Martin Luther and this move that was taking place in Europe. And so I don't think it's an oversimplification to say 1517 was the year when the vast ice field of the Romish papacy was holed. And we know that that took place in Germany. Now, the issue that brought that to a head, you know the story, was indulgences. The selling of papal indulgences for the forgiveness of sins and the lessening of time in purgatory. It has to be pointed out that that commenced in Italy. They were papal indulgences authorised and signed by him, and his envoys were sent out to sell them. So it began in Italy, and we're not surprised that Rome was going to reap, even in its own backyard, what it sowed in Germany. Now, the Pope at this time was Leo X. That's Tetzel, who of course sold the indulgences in Germany, and Luther encountered him and challenged him and wrote the 95 Theses in response to him. Tetzel died shortly after that in the year 1519. This is an artist's impression, an old print of Wittenberg, and you see the castle church there on the very left, the tall spire there on the very left, and that's the castle church itself today before the latest renovations that took place for the 1517 anniversary. You see the red there, that's where the door is, that's just a colouring in. The door now is built into the building. The old door was destroyed, and that's how it would have looked there originally. Those are the doors today, built in, a wee bit more into the building. They're built with bronze, and the 95 Theses are engraved on them. But anyway, back to Pope Leo X. He was the Pope at the time, and you see his dates there. He was born in 1475, and he died in 1521. He belonged to the wealthy, high-flying family, the Medicis, And they were from Florence, and he was the second son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, who was the ruler of Florence. That was a family who was very influential in Florence for many generations, a very wealthy family, and they were high-flying in society, in all walks of society, in state and in church. And many members of their family had high ambitions on the papacy, and of course Leo X, the second son of Lorenzo, got that job. And then after him, his cousin, Clemens, he also became Pope after the death of Leo. So corruption and immorality was the order of the day for this family, the Medici family from Florence. It was grandeur at any cost, and that was a hallmark of the family and all the members of the family. And Pope Leo X was no exception. He carried those hallmarks into Rome. He became a cardinal in 1489 when he was only 14 years of age. He was ordained to the priesthood as a child, and he commenced his papacy in March 1513. 4 years before Luther nailed his theses, and ended it when he died in December 1521 at 45 years of age. So Luther came in the middle of his time as Pope, in the halfway mark, and the last 4 years of his life was a bit of a headache for Leo, dealing with the rise of the Reformed faith. So as I say, Leo X had this disease of aiming for grandeur at any cost that belonged to the family, and he carried that in his own life. He started a costly war in 1517 to secure a dukedom for his nephew. He also exercised his zeal for grandeur of art and buildings, and he wanted to continue the completion of the grand reconstruction of St. Peter's Basilica. And the shortage of money was a bit of a problem, and the getting of the money, he of course had plenty of it, the family had plenty of it, but they weren't too willing to pay for all the cost of it. And so they come up with the grand scheme of selling indulgences. Through people buying these, they would get the coppers for the rebuilding of the basilica. And so Tetzel was sent out on that task in the states of Germany and in the area where Luther lived. Luther challenged Tetzel, and he wrote the 95 Theses. That's Leo X there. And on his left there is a cousin, Clemens, who became the next pope. That's Clemens VII. His popedom was from 1521 to 1534. So these are the two main popes at the start of the Reformation in Italy. But anyway, thesis number 86. Why does not the Pope build St. Peter's Minster, that's the cathedral, with his own money, since his riches are now more ample than those of Crassus, rather than with the money of poor Christians? So Luther was not ignorant of the riches of Leo X, and he wondered why he just didn't build it himself, rather than through this means of frauding the people and the selling of indulgences. But the Pope wasn't going to spend the money, except the money that it cost for the ink to sign the indulgences. It was the people who were going to have to spend the money to get the forgivenesses of their sins and build the basilica. And so, unfortunately for Rome, they chose Germany as a main land in which to sell these indulgences. And in those days, selling papal indulgences was big money. You understand that, because people actually believed in the authority and power of the papacy. It was a time of superstition. It was a time of fear of death. People were afraid of death, and they were afraid of the after death and the judgment. They really believed in purgatory as a place of suffering. They reckoned they would probably go there, but they knew it was still terrible suffering and a long time. So all of these superstitions filled the people with fear. And they had a reverence for the authority of the Pope, the belief that was from Peter, the belief that was established by Christ. And so anything the papacy said, it was often believed. And of course, Roman Catholicism is an easy religion. You don't have to repent and forsake sin. You just have to go through the ritual and the superstition. And so it's a nice easy way to get the forgiveness of sins, just to spend a wee bit of money. And you can live really as you please. So indulgences, the people would think, are a real bargain. And the money was soon flowing into Germany, and the confessional boxes in the churches were emptying, and Luther was noticing that his church attendance was going down, and he soon discovered the reason. And he challenged, as I said, Tetzel with the 95 Theses. Soon these 95 Theses were being printed. That's an early copy there, 1522 copy of Luther's 95 Theses. That's not the earliest copy, but they were soon being printed and distributed through various parts of Germany and within a number of years into other European countries as well. Other things in the Theses said, they will be forever damned along with those who teach it. Those who believe indulgence letters ensure salvation. Christians should be taught that one who sees his neighbour in need and neglects him or her to buy indulgences does not buy the Pope's indulgence, but God's indignation. And then Luther said this, why does not the Pope deliver all souls at the same time out of purgatory for the sake of most holy love and on account of the bitterest distress of those souls, this being the most imperative of all motives? While he saves an infinite number of souls for the sake of that most miserable thing, money, to be spent on St. Peter's Minster, this being the very slightest of motives. The Augustinians were ordered by the papacy to impose silence on their monks after this outcry from Luther and the trouble beginning to spread across Germany. And Luther himself was commanded to go to Rome, but that was changed, and instead he went to Augsburg and he met Cardinal Cajetan, and he was there to try to explain these 95 Theses. Luther wouldn't change, he wouldn't water down his 95 Theses, he wouldn't withdraw them, and soon papal bulls were issued, and final one came in 1521. Whenever he was finally excommunicated, and we know the story what Luther did with that, he burns the bull in 1521. And so with that excommunication, nearly 4 years after the nailing of the 95 Theses, Luther was finally put out of the Church of Rome. But it was too late. Leo had lacked the will and the power to silence Luther, and the damage was irreversible, really. Luther, you see, hadn't stopped at the 95 Theses. He'd been writing other things. He'd been writing other tracts and printing other leaflets. And he had been engaging in writing several books, especially in 1520. Several books came out in 1520. He was beginning to see that the Pope was the Antichrist. His memories of his visit to Rome in 1510 came flooding back again, and it all just fell into place, and he wondered how he was so blind to the darkness and to the superstition of the papacy, and he began to proclaim the papacy and to write about the papacy as Antichrist. And so three of his best known works were published in 1520. That's the edition of Appeal to the Christian Nobility of the German Nation. And he wrote to the nation here an appeal to the nobility of the nation about the universal priesthood of believers that followed out of justification, that all believers were priests unto God, all had right of access unto God, and that the people were free and liberated from the shackles and the bondage of papal superstition. And then in 1520 he published his prelude on the Babylonian captivity, the same year, a few months later. He dealt here with the sacraments accepting only baptism and the Lord's Supper. He argued for the use of the cup in the Lord's Supper, and he exposed many of the superstitions of Romanism in that book, The False Sacraments. And then in 1520 he wrote a treatise on good deeds, good works, their relationship to grace and to salvation, how that salvation was based on grace and faith, and that good works, while not a necessity in salvation, did flow out of salvation. So he was just setting in place the proper order and place of works in the life of the child of God and in the Christian. So the matter really that caused the Reformation to arise out of Italy, or arise in Italy, and especially in the north of Italy, but as far down even as Rome and parts of Naples, the problem was Luther's writings arrived. That was really the big factor in the Reformation. The 95 Theses very soon were being distributed in parts of Europe, and they were of course making their way into Italy. And of course the people could see the corruption of Rome and of the papacy. They weren't blind to it. Everybody knew in their heart the system wasn't right, it needed reformed. But whenever a monk was so bold as to challenge it, and his challenge went viral, really, it really opened up minds and opened up eyes. In Italy, there was a very good response to these writings of Luther. So it was Luther's writings that got the ball rolling in Italy. They were initially in Latin. The educated could all read in Latin. All of Europe, the educated in Europe, could all read Latin and speak in Latin, and that was how they could speak and communicate between each other. So there was no problem reading Luther's writings amongst the educated classes, in the clergy and in the nobility. But they did begin to be translated also into Italian. Now we know that as early as 1519, Luther's writings were going into Italy, circulating in several parts of it. In 1520, some of his works could be found in Italian bookshops, and especially in Venice. And there are records of that, booksellers selling the books in Italy. It was becoming easy to obtain his works initially. It became a wee bit harder later on, as the papal bull was being implemented and advertised and made known around all the cities of Italy. The booksellers, while they were able to sell them, were selling Luther's writings. And they, not only were the booksellers bringing them, but the writings were being brought in by others. And there were being the ideas of Luther, the thoughts and the doctrines of the Protestant Reformation were being discussed throughout Italy. And I just want to speak to you about how that came about. It was mainly through travellers. As I said, the Reformed faith was a foreign thing in Italy. It came from outside and it came to Italy. Like Italy became a kind of a mission field for the Reformers. And there were young men who studied in Wittenberg and studied in Geneva. And they went into Italy as missionaries to bring the gospel. But apart from that, and even before that, the ideas of Luther were spreading widely through Italy in the early 1520s. And it was mainly from four different groups that this was happening. And I want to speak about those four groups now. Travellers, the travelling groups, the people who crossed from Germany into Italy and vice versa from Italy back to Germany. These were the groups that were carrying the ideas. And these were the people who were bringing the literature, the tracts, and the writings. And these groups were the ones really who are responsible for the spread of the Reformation in Italy in the early days. The first group, of course, is the clergy. And monks and priests and clerics of all different kinds were always travelling between the countries, between monasteries and between churches and between cities. And these clerics, on their various business, either from Germany to Italy or from Italy to Germany, They were getting acquainted with all the talk of the day and all the ideas of Luther. And some of these monks were converted and brought to faith. And so there was this means amongst the clergy themselves where the ideas were transferring from mind to mind. Some of the clergy were just curious, and some of them just wanted to find Lutheran literature and bring it back to their monastery and bring it back to their own library. It may have just been curiosity. Some were genuinely interested in the Reformed ideas. There were searchers and there were seekers, and they came back with the writings because of that. The writings of Luther through the vehicle of the travelling clergy were getting into Italy, and they were being found in monasteries and convents and in the libraries of the clergy. One example of that is Frederick the Wise. Frederick the Wise, of course, he was born in 1463 and died in 1525. Frederick III, the Elector of Saxony, he was the one who sheltered and protected Luther and kept him from the attacks of Rome. But he had a great interest in relics. He had a great interest in his university. He was interested in education. He had collected thousands and thousands of religious relics over the years, thousands and thousands, and they were very valuable at that time. And he had men in Italy looking out for relics and collecting relics. And one of the men that he had was a man called Schenck. And Schenck was there in Italy. Actually, he was a monk, but he was there in Italy as part of his work for the Elector of Saxony. And part of his task was to purchase relics for the new University of Wittenberg. And he was writing back to Frederick the Wise through Frederick's secretary, Bellatinus, George Bellatinus. That's a picture of him there when he was very young. He was initially the librarian for Frederick the Wise, but he became his chaplain and his secretary. And he was the one responsible for all the communications from Frederick the Wise to all the diplomats and all the famous people throughout Italy and other parts of Europe. Now, this man was the one who dealt directly with Luther. Frederick the Wise, I don't think, ever met Luther. And the communications between them were by letter, correspondence. And it was this man who would do the corresponding. And all of Luther's, or many of Luther's letters to this man, Spalatinus, are still existent, though his letters to Luther don't exist, and Luther's letters to him are very interesting reading, I understand. But anyway, the monk in Italy, looking for relics, wrote a letter to Frederick the Wise through his secretary, and he was telling him how he had been reading Luther's writings, how Luther's writings were widely available in Venice, and how that they were quickly selling out of the bookshops. And so this is one evidence of how Luther's writings were making grounds in the city of Venice. So the clergy, for various reasons in Italy, were a means of bringing the ideas and doctrines of Luther. Then another class of people would be called the students, the academic students, the young men. There was an interest in learning in Italy, the Renaissance and humanism. There were many young men from noble families and from well-to-do families, and they wanted to go to Germany, to go to the universities there, and some of them even wanted to go to Wittenberg itself. And so, and again, there were Germans who were interested in Italy, in the Renaissance, in the literature and in the art especially. There's a lot of art taking place in Italy, and there's a German interest in that. So there's these young men going back and forth between Germany and Italy through the studies, through the academics, through the arts, and through literature. And these men also were trading thoughts and ideas and doctrines, and by that means the Reformed faith is gaining ground amongst the young people who are educated in Italy. And as I said, there were some even visited Wittenberg just to see and hear Luther himself, this monk whose hammer on the door of the church echoed across the Alps in the ears of the papacy. Then another group of travellers, now you must remember the people themselves didn't travel much between countries. There's a travelling community, but they belong to the academics, they belong to the clergy. But another group, of course, is the diplomatic corps, the nobles, and we could include in this the merchants, the men who are bringing the goods to sell and who are coming back with goods as well, the traders. And this is another group who are the travelling people. And there was actually a merchant colony in some of the cities, a German merchant colony, and this was the case in Venice. There was a colony of Germans in Venice, and many of them were Lutherans. And so through the merchants and the diplomats from the Protestant states, these were men who were allowed, because of their power and influence, who were allowed to talk about these ideas. And they did talk about these ideas, and they brought their books with them, and they gave away literature free. So this was another area of the travelling community who brought the seed of the word into Italy and the distribution of the literature. But then there's another class that crisscrossed Europe and even at times entered into Italy, and especially in the 1520s, whenever the Reformation is really beginning in Italy. And that was the military, the soldiers. Soldiers were among the travellers of the late Middle Ages. These are the main people travelling in the Middle Ages. And of course, any new idea in one country will go to another country, and it will mainly go through one of these four sources. So these soldiers are doing that. And many of these soldiers now, of course, are Lutherans. They belong to some of the German states, and they belong to the armies and some of the regiments of Charles V, Emperor Charles V. That's a picture of Venice, by the way, an artist's impression of it in the 16th century. That's a map of Venice. You see, it still has plenty of water. Hasn't changed much in that regard. So that's Venice. It was a great trading post and a great place for the bringing in of ideas from Germany. And it was one of the best places for the early beginnings of the Reformation in Italy. But anyway, talking about the soldiers, I was trying to click on to that photograph, that portrait of the Emperor Charles himself. He was the ruler of the Spanish Empire and then became the Holy Roman Emperor in 1519, just a young man. He was the one who was at the Diet of Worms whenever Luther was at it. He had promised him safety and he kept his word, and Luther was allowed to leave the Diet unharmed, though he was in great danger. But he was protected, as we know, by the kidnapping arranged by Frederick the Wise. But anyway, the Lutherans in the armies and in the regiments of the Holy Roman Emperor, many of them were Lutherans. And they would travel different parts of Europe because it was a time of many wars in Europe. Europe was endlessly at war. In fact, to study the European wars would nearly be, you'd have to go to university nearly to do it. It was very complex. And it would take a lot of time to go through all the ins and outs and all the stories and all the changes that took place through the very, very many European wars in the late medieval ages into the time of the Protestant Reformation and beyond it, when they became largely religious wars amongst Protestants and Catholics. But without going into all the detail about the religious wars and the European wars, these soldiers obviously were travelling about very many places, and they're bringing their books, they're bringing their Bibles, they're bringing their ideas, They're bringing their faith. And whenever they come into Roman Catholic states, they see the contrast. And they talk to the community about it. And when they came to Italy, that was the case. And of course, the locals weren't too hard to persuade sometimes, because they themselves seen the abuses and the immorality and the darkness of the papacy. So this by this means, the soldiers are bringing their ideas and they're talking about their reformed faith in Italy. And there was a particular period of time when Lutheran soldiers were in Italy under the emperor, and other times whenever they were mercenaries in wars that were taking place in Italy. So the Alps didn't prevent Italy being drawn into the European wars, and foreign armies crossed the Alps on occasions, and there were, in actual fact, about 5 major Italian wars between 1517 and 1560, that early period of the Reformation in that land. There were 5 major Italian wars. So quite a few Lutherans were in Italy by these means. And so these 4 different groups. Now, there is an interesting story in the 1520s, whenever German troops were besieging Italian cities, and in 1527, some of the regiments of Emperor Charles ransacked Rome. And there was a famous sacking of Rome that took place in 1527. And Pope Clement VII was the Pope at that time in Rome. And he was shut up in a castle in the city. This is an old artist's impression of Rome. Now you can see they're mainly cities, mainly churches and cathedrals. Various, most of the places that are identified are numbered. And they're mostly of interest to pilgrims. So this was a sort of a map for pilgrims to visit the various places. This is St. Peter's Basilica here. And this is the castle in the city. And it was in that castle that whenever the city was besieged and eventually ransacked, it was in that castle that the Pope Clement was locked up, and where he was hiding and being protected from the sacking that was taking place around the city. So he was besieged and imprisoned in that castle. And at that time, the ransacking of Rome was carried out by many of the Lutherans in the regiments of the emperor. And there's a famous tale and that is told of that time. It's a great amusing sort of play that took place that the soldiers themselves created. They got one of their members, one of the soldiers, they dressed him up as the Pope, and they put the triple crown on his head, and some of the other soldiers proceeded to dress up as cardinals and friars and monks and different clergy. And then they read themselves. And then they had a march of procession that moved through these streets of Rome, right down to the castle itself. And the Pope was able to watch them outside his castle. And there they went. They did a great show, a great pageantry. They said that the Pope now was kicked off his throne. And they said, Luther's a new Pope. Luther's a new Pope, and we're going to crown Luther the new Pope. And all the soldiers were shouting out, long live Pope Martin Luther, long live Pope Martin Luther. So you see that there was a really strong influence, Lutheran influence at that time, in the city of Rome. And that took place under the eye, as I say, of Clement VII. Now, I only mention that just as to kind of amuse you and to break maybe the monotony of this lecture. It was an attack that Luther wasn't happy with. He, of course, had no power to stop it. It was a political thing. It was nothing to do with religion. There were just Lutherans in the regiments at that time. He didn't glory in the behaviour of the ransacking of the city and all that took place. And in actual fact, it really backfired against the Reformation, because the Roman Catholics used it to put fear in parts of Italy and said this is really the result of Protestantism, violence and anarchy. This is what Lutherans do whenever they penetrate down to Rome. And so it really backfired against the Reformation, and the Counter-Reformation used it to put fear into the people against the Protestants and their faith. But I do mention it to show that foreign Lutherans had penetrated deeply into Italy. And on their way down, they're spreading ideas, they're talking, they're distributing books. So it's really by this means that the Reformed faith is being spread amongst the people. And it also showed how vulnerable the papacy was. You know, it could have been ruined and destroyed at this time. It was very vulnerable. And there were Protestants who were beginning to think, in terms of prophecy of Scripture and the Antichrist and the fall of the Antichrist and the millennium of blessing, of gospel blessing. And there were those who were beginning to think that this was these times. It was a time of the downfall of the Antichrist. And so, but it wasn't to be. It wasn't to be. So the Reformed faith, it got this start and it looked good, but it wasn't to be. And Protestantism, you can see why Protestantism was looked upon as foreign, and it was looked upon sometimes as violent, and therefore that became a great argument in the Counter-Reformation. But as I say, in reality it wasn't a Protestant army, it was Charles V army, but it went renegade at Rome. And so then, to get back to my subject, all these groups were bringing Reformed ideas and Reformed literature. And Lutheranism was quietly and slowly spreading. Now, there were playwriters at that time. You usually get a good measure of the temperature of a nation by what's being written in the plays. What's the latest ideas? What's the latest craze? What's the thing that's, you know, going viral now and spreading? Usually in the plays and in the theatres in the ancient times, that's where you got the news about that and the joking about that, and that was being used as the thing in the latest dramas for the stage. And playwriters and plays in Italian cities were now using puns from Luther's life and from Luther's influence on the Italian state. And some of the plays depicted Luther as the lute player, and everybody was following his tune. Now, it was just an exaggerated joke. All of Italy isn't following his tune, but it's growing, and it's becoming such a marked thing that the playwriters are including it as something that's happening in their society. And another playwriter, he wrote in his play that nobody bothers with images now, except those who look at the images on their playing cards. And so that's, again, another kind of a joke and a jest. But it is showing how Lutheranism is taking away the idolatry and the lessening the devotion to the images. It's really happening. It's really being talked about in society. And so the Reformed faith is making inroads. And Luther himself was getting reports about his books in Italy and how the ideas in Wittenberg were spreading to the Italian cities, particularly Venice. And Luther rejoiced at this news, and he was glad of it, and he thanked God for it, and he was anticipating even yet greater things. That was in the early 1520s. But it changed. It changed so much that by the next century, exactly 100 years later, 1622, the main lawyer in Venice, he could say, through the grace of God, there had been no heretics in this city. In fact, I have a quotation here. That was a castle, by the way, in which the Pope was locked up and looking out at the great pageantry and the sacking of Rome that was taking place under his very nose. Yes, this is what the lawyer said in 1622. He said, by the grace of God, there are no heretics in this city, and for decades there has been no trial for formal heresy, but only for some looseness of speech that has been indulged. So that was 100 years later, and that's more or less an admission. There's no Protestants here anymore. There are no Lutherans here anymore. We don't have to worry here anymore about these ideas. It's all gone, and we haven't even had to have a court case about it. 100 years later. So the Reformation had been totally suppressed by 100 years later. In fact, a long time before that 100 years. But it was totally suppressed by the Counter-Reformation. But in the early 1520s and 30s, up until 1542 was a really bad year. Things really changed then. But up until that, the Reformed faith was looking good. It was spreading well. People were being changed. And it looked like the land itself might open to Protestantism. But as I say, that wasn't the happy ending. And Venice wasn't alone. Venice wasn't alone. This was being replicated in many cities in Italy. It was these factors then which drove Pope Leo to finally produce his bull of excommunication in 1521, the spread of the ideas in the Italian cities. He took so long to do it because he didn't want to hurt the feelings of Frederick the Wise, and that's why he held back so long. But eventually, even his feelings for Frederick the Wise, just they had to go to one side. And the bull of excommunication, which put Luther under a ban and under really liberty to kill and to bring to court and to try for and to execute, he was under that the rest of his life. So as I say, these foreign writings were being brought in, but not only were they being brought in, there were soon printers in Italy who were printing them, and Italian printers were translating some of the books themselves. Translators were translating them into Italian, and printers were printing them. And it wasn't just Luther's writings. There were Melanchthon's writings, Bucer's writings, the writings of Zwingli. They were all read in parts of Italy. But after the papal bulls were published against Lutheranism, the Italian towns and cities became a wee bit more stricter, and it became a wee bit more underground, and there had to be more sort of careful means of getting the books out. But they still got out. There's always an underground system, no matter what you do, and the literature still got out. And some of the means and methods of getting Reformed literature out under these papal bans and the danger of prosecution, either to the printers, to the writers, and to the distributors, there were various amusing stories and methods and ways of overcoming this. Now, some of the books began to be published under fictitious names, or the real name was disguised. It was maybe produced in another language. The meaning of the name, maybe in German, was looked at in Italian or in another foreign language, and that was the name that was used. So it wasn't totally lies and deceit. It was just using a wee bit of subtlety, being as wise as serpents. But sometimes the same literature was going out under these fictitious names. And there are some amusing stories of Melanchthon's writings and other reformers' writings being read at Rome. And there's one man who relates a particular story about this. He says, Cardinal Serafin was at that time counsellor of the papal Rota. He came to me one day and he said, we have had a most laughable business before us today. The commonplaces of Philip Melanchthon were printed at Venice under an Italian title. And these commonplaces were sent to Rome. They were freely bought for the space of a whole year, and they were read with great applause, so that the copies being exhausted, an order was sent to Venice for a fresh supply. But in the meantime, a Franciscan friar, who possessed a copy of the original edition, discovered the trick and denounced the book as a Lutheran production from the pen of Melanchthon. And now it was proposed to punish the poor printer, who probably could not read one word of the book, but at last it was agreed to burn all the copies that they could get hold of and just keep the whole affair quiet. And that happened on numerous occasions. So actually in Rome, the cardinals and the clergy of Rome, they were reading these books, these religious books, and they thought, these are great, this is good, you know. But they didn't know it was Melanchthon and the reformers who had actually authored them and written them. And of course, whenever they were recognized as Lutheran, the previous enjoyment of them all had to be denied, and they had to be exposed as heretical. And that actually happened with Luther's epistle to the Romans, his introduction to his epistle on the Romans, and his treatise on justification. They were all going out under different names, and they were being well read in cities of Italy, even in Rome itself. Martin Bucer's commentary on the Psalms was sold in Italy under a fictitious name. And there were other examples and stories about this. So this is one of the methods by which, whenever it was difficult to get Reformed literature out, they just changed the names and then took away the Lutheran covering, and the books were getting read and the ideas were getting into people's minds, and they didn't even know they were Lutheran writings. But about 1536, copies of a new work were beginning to flow into Italy. It was John Calvin's Institutes. Shortly after the completion of his Institutes, John Calvin Institutes, the first edition of it was written in Latin in 1536. I think it was 1536. And then the French, which was his own native language, in 1541. But there were various editions. It was a growing systematic theology until its final edition, the definitive work, appeared in Latin in 1559 and in French then in 1560. And these covered all the areas of the Reformed faith. It was very strong in its opposition to Roman Catholic superstition, very strong in the doctrine of justification by faith and the right use of the two sacraments of baptism and the Lord's Supper. Shortly after the completion of that work, Calvin actually came to Ferrara in Italy, and he made some vital contacts there. He came in disguise. It was quite a secret mission, but he came and he was very influential. He made some very important contacts. He made a contact with one of the men who became the translator of the Psalms that would have been used in the singing in the Geneva churches. And he came in contact with Lady or Madame Rini, who was a very influential lady in the court in that state. And so he had meetings, and he was interviewed about his Institutes of the Christian Religion. And through the distribution of his Institutes and the contacts that he made in that quick visit there, the Reformed faith got fairly well established in that city, and Madame Rini did all that she could to spread the Reformed faith and give that environment for clergy and for all the nobles to feel at liberty to speak about these things without any danger to their persons. And so that was a very important visit of Calvin, and the Institutes were becoming very influential in the 30s and in the early 40s. Enough about Reformed literature. Very quickly, and time is gone and I can't spend long on this, the Italian Reformation is not just the story of early Reformed Protestant literature. It's the story of the Italian Bible. It's the story of the distribution of the scriptures in the native tongue of the people. Now, Italian was not necessarily the universal tongue in all the Italian states. You know, in the north, they would have spoke French quite a bit, especially up in Piedmont, amongst the Waldensians. So there were other languages too, and there were various dialects of the Italian language. But Italian was fairly common, and it was becoming more so. But when the Italian Bible was formed, it kind of did what the Tyndale Bible did in Britain. It cemented the language, the English language. It gathered the English language together as one, free of all the different dialects. And so it kind of brought unity to the English language. And the Italian Bible did the same. It was very helpful to the unifying of the Italian states in the long run because of what it did for the Italian language and the Bible. That's the real cause of the Reformation. We know that, don't we? The Reformation was itself fired up by the Bible, commenced by the Bible, infused and empowered by the Bible. The Reformed writings were out of the Bible and about the Bible, and the Reformed writings accompanied the Bible, and the Reformed faith was expounding the Bible. So it's all about the Bible. And so the Reformed faith brought the Bible to the people of Italy. They needed an Italian Bible, and that's another story in itself. Whether we get into that story or not, I'm not sure, but that's another factor in the Italian Reformation, getting the Bible. And that was the same in every European country. We know that. We know the history of the Reformation in our own land and how Tyndale's Bible was so important to that. And it's the same story in Italy. And so it's God's work, and it's largely arising out of the Word of God. And the Bible is being talked about. And the Reformed literature is coming, but people want to get the Bible. They want to see the Scriptures. Is it right? Is this true? Is it out of the Bible? And they were beginning to compare Roman Catholic superstition and Protestant theology from the Word of God, and beginning to have Bible meetings and talking about the Word of God. And of course, Italy was conducive to that because of the Renaissance, the openness about literature, about language, about Greek and Hebrew. There was a Jewish community spread in different parts of Italy. A lot of knowledge about Hebrew. It all came out of Italy. So that land is conducive to ancient literature, Greek and Hebrew, and it was open to the reception of good translation of the Bible into the Italian language. So that's another factor. It's not just the Reformed literature, Luther, yes, got the ball rolling, but what really gave it impetus was the Bible, the Word of God. That is powerful. But still, there was a counter-reformation, and it was all suppressed, as we know. And maybe we begin to look at some personalities in a wee bit more detail in the next class. But that'll do us for tonight.